This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, and may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will waste harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, I apologize for forgetting to do the chanting almost. Luckily, Ananda was looking at me like... hint, hint. So I was saying that I was sitting in my room starting to think about tomorrow already. I thought, the last questions and answer session. And then I don't have to answer any questions anymore. But that made me a little bit restless. You get this energy of the mind that wants to move into the future. So I thought, I'll do something silly. I imagined that all of you got together in a secret meeting that I didn't know about. And you all decided, 5 days is much too short. Let's make it a 9-day retreat. and you went to Ajahn Brahm and said, soon you should do a 9-day retreat, and Ajahn Brahm said to me, you do a 9-day retreat or you have to pack your bags. And it sort of worked. So maybe tomorrow there's another questions and answers, but probably not. How many do we have, actually? So I can sort of judge. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Oh, they multiplied. They're like rabbits. Okay. Oh, that's. Okay. Okay. At Bodhinyana recently, I had a visitor say, so these monks are basically orange-wearing, privately funded dole bludgers. What's a dole bludger? What do they do for anyone? How could I answer her about how the Bodhinyana monks help not just the lay people, but also the wider community? Yeah, we are dole bludgers.
The
bijstand. Okay, somebody's Dutch here, he says. Now I understand. Oh, okay. Well, we don't earn any money at all, so we're not dole bludgers then. Right? So how could you answer about the monks? Just send them to us and we'll answer the question. I don't know. Well, we do a lot of teachings like this, and people get a lot of benefit out of it, and we don't get paid anything for it. And do teachings overseas, online, but it's not just the teachings. Buddhists get a lot of inspiration often out of seeing monastics, not just in Bodhinyana, but in Dhammasara and other monasteries as well, to see how we can live a simple life and still be happy. And that is something that I think the world needs more of, especially in this day and age where everything is so fast and everything is about materialism with social media and stuff. Everything is about getting more stuff. Well, maybe not everything, but a lot of stuff. And you need some counter movement to that. You need some people who are able to step out of society and give an example for others. And you could also look at it like that. We don't even get paid at all, right? Well, we get a roof over our head and some food. That's even worse than dole bludgers. But people are happy to provide those things for us. Yeah? So in the end, everybody is dependent upon other people. People think, I'm making my money, I am self-sufficient, I can survive by myself in the world. But the next day you might get fired, you know, or something. You're dependent upon your boss just as much as we are dependent upon our community of lay supporters. Or that you're dependent upon your customers or whatever. We're all dependent upon one another. And as monks, we just make it more visible. And that person notices that. And they think that is a bad thing, to be dependent upon other people. But it's not, actually. I think it's a beautiful thing. And to be honest, when I first became a monk, that was one of the hardest things, actually, about it. To be so vulnerable and dependent upon other people. All my life I had this idea like I'm going to be self-sufficient, taking care of myself, and now I can't even cook my own food. Wow, it's really scary sometimes. Well, not anymore, but at the start it was. And so it's also something actually quite difficult to do. Okay, Regarding today's attachment to the body-mind contemplation, are there any daily practices outside of meditation that can be done to lessen attachment desire to the body and mind? You can do, well, outside of meditation, you ask specifically. I think it's most effective inside of meditation. Outside of meditation, I can't really think of a... Wear very ugly clothes, maybe. And make sure you don't look good. And I don't know. I would just keep that for meditation, as I would myself. To appreciate a sunset, the smell that permeates of a flower, and the teachings of the Buddha, are these not sensual desires? Well, the first few are, but the teachings of the Buddha are not sensual desires. They are spiritual things. When one is not attached but yet finds joy in these moments, is it correct that sensual desires are now renounced? Okay, well, I said you can find lots of beauty in the forest here. You can find a lot of beauty in sunsets and flowers, and there's nothing wrong with that, actually. And you can actually get a lot of benefit out of that as well for your meditation. And it's even in the sutta, some of the enlightened monks say, I'm enjoying just the quiet of this forest and the beauty of the surroundings. But they enjoy it for the peace that it brings and not for the sensuality. So things like sunsets and the smell of a flower are not like super sensual, so it's not a big hindrance or anything. So don't worry about that. But the teachings of the Buddha, they are definitely not sensual, and you can enjoy them as much as you want. I hope I understood the question correctly. Hi, Venerable Sunyo. Why do I feel myself become big and thick when I am doing meditation? Thank you. Well, that's because of all the lovely food we've been getting. Thank you. Let's say sadhu to the people in the kitchen. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And to all the donors, sadhu. Yes, me and Venerable Ananda, we had a cake, apple crumble, and ice cream, three desserts on one day. So I also feel myself become big and thick when doing meditation. Yes. And at some point, Ajahn Brahm said to me, I am so... Voluminous. It's the fault of the lay people. I didn't put it exactly like that. He was just saying people give a lot of food, so that's why. But that's, of course, a silly answer. It is, you're meaning something different. You're meaning you sit in meditation and you have the feeling like your body might be expanding, something like that. And that is very natural. When you sit down and meditate, close your eyes, become still, sometimes the mind can do funny things with perceptions. I told you before how I had the boiling water on my hand and I changed the perception to make it feel nice. And the mind can do many other weird perceptions. And I think this is most common to new meditators when they're not, or maybe meditators will suddenly increase the amount of meditation they do, like in a retreat like this. Your mind starts playing around a bit with perceptions. Maybe it's just wants to try something new, see what happens. And you can have these perceptions as if your body is changing in some weird way. Like you might have the feeling like you're floating, or like you're sinking into the ground, or you have the feeling like you're leaning over And then you open your eyes and you're actually sitting straight. All these sorts of things. Or other weird perceptions happen. And they are very, very common. Actually, I'm surprised the question only comes up now. And for you, it happens to be that your mind imagines like your body is expanding. Yeah, that can happen. I've had many of those kind of weird perceptions as well. And at some point, my body was like expanding like it was the whole universe. It felt like really strange. And then a moment later, it was like a 2D universe. Like I felt like I was a sheet of paper stretched out. Really strange. Then I became a line, like a line. And then a dot. I felt my body was just a dot in space. Some people think those are very deep states of meditation, but they're not. They're just your mind playing around a bit. And you're still aware of your body, so it's not not even like a jhana yet. But it's interesting. You can just look at it and see what happens. Usually your mind has some sort of some peace to some extent. So it's good. Good sign, usually. But don't get trapped in it. And first of all, don't worry about it. Second of all, don't also not get attached to it, because sometimes it can feel very pleasant, those kind of perceptions. Because you're getting away from your body a bit, that's why that happens. Dear Venerable Sunyo, today you talked about the sound of silence being most pleasant. Ajahn Sumedho describes a humming or ringing resonance in the mind which can appear like a sound as the sound of silence. I have had this experience too, particularly when I become more peaceful. I notice this humming. Have you practiced with this? Is there anything in the suttas that the Buddha taught that would explain this? Thanks and metta. Well, last question, no, there's nothing about it in the suttas, about sound of silence. I would also say that a humming or ringing is not a silence. I don't know why somebody would call that sound of silence. Well, it's sort of a sound, but it's not silence. By silence, I mean you don't hear anything at all, not even a ringing. It just, your mind has withdrawn from the whole auditory field, as it were. You can't hear anything at all. And that is difficult to do in meditation, but it's possible. And you know it's possible because sometimes you might be watching like something on the television and somebody says something to you and you don't hear them at all. Or you might even be reading something and somebody says something or whatever and you don't hear it. So you're so focused on the thing you're reading, you can't hear the outside world. Do you recognize that? Yeah. So it's the same as possible in meditation, where you're so focused on your breathing, for example, or the joy of the mind, and that is all your mind cares about. And that is all that it focuses on. And then the sounds will start to disappear. One time, my ex-girlfriend said, "You haven't heard a single word I said, have you?" And I thought, "Oh, that's a strange way to start a conversation." That's a joke. That didn't actually happen. I am a very good listener. Is Ajahn Brahm enlightened? Ajahn Brahm would answer, there is no Ajahn Brahm. No question. Oh, that's good. That helps. I hope the rest is like that. Just want to say thank you for all your teachings. I have found them to be very helpful and fun with metta. Okay. Well, I'll keep that one. Okay. It looks like a whole story, but it's not that bad, actually. How should one feel, think, or act about a family member being abusive sexually? Okay. It's not that nice. It did not happen to me, but to my cousins 20 plus years ago. I'm conflicted as I only have good memories with this person. Now the past has been shed a light and I'm not sure how to react. Any advice how to react from an emotional point of view with metta?
I've never been in such a situation before. And it's a little bit probably the angry crocodile again, but now the crocodile is not angry, but has lots of desires, bad desires. And I'm not going to make a story up with that, but you can imagine how that person who did those acts is somehow very unhappy inside to do that sort of thing. And I'm not sure if it will be able to forgive that easily, but at least maybe you might be able to understand. And all unenlightened people have some qualities that are not ideal, let's put it that way. And many people in the world, they have good qualities, but also bad qualities. And don't judge a person just by one thing they did, because people are always multifaceted, and they have other sides to them as well. This is a very big thing, so it might sort of cloud over all the rest they've done. But try and also remember the good sides of that person as well. And that those sort of people need a lot of emotional support themselves as well, because I'm sure they're not happy about what they're doing. That's all I sort of can say. I don't have any very particular enlightening advice about that, because I've never been in that situation myself, so yeah. Dear teacher, what would you say to those of us who want the best of both worlds, the pleasure of meditation and the pleasures the senses can give us? Good luck. This is actually, well, we're doing the simile of the Snake Sutta with Ajahn Brahmani and Bodhinyana, and it starts off with some person saying, oh, the indulging in the senses is not obstructive to attaining the full benefits of the path. I'm paraphrasing it a little bit because it's a little bit cryptic how it's phrased in the sutta, but that's what he says. Like indulging, I think it especially means like sexual pleasures. Like indulging in sexual pleasures is not obstructive to becoming enlightened. That's what he says. And then the Buddha says, you foolish man. Have I not told you many times that those things are obstructive to the path in full? However, you're also lay people, you're not monks, and you're not yet on, maybe not at parts of the path where that matters as much yet. And there's still in the suttas also like what they call once returners, and there's like a once returner's two brothers, and one is celibate and the other is still sexually active. And then people go and ask, I think the Buddha, why is that so? And then the Buddha said they have different inclinations and they're in different places. So eventually that other non-returner who is still sexually active will have to give it up as well to become a non-returner. That's when you don't have no more sensual desires. But you can still have lots of pleasure of meditation and sometimes pleasure of the senses. But if you want to go all the way, then you have to give up the pleasures of the senses. But that's very far advanced upon the path, so it might not be something you personally have to worry about yet. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your very useful teachings, and thank you for your good jokes. Ajahn Brahm has serious competition. I've heard people say, like,
Ajahn Brahm is having a big influence or something. But I'm pretty sure I would be teaching the same if I never met Ajahn Brahm, because I just teach the way I feel like. And it's nice that I got some encouragement from Ajahn Brahm. And yeah, we can maybe do a joke competition one day. But I'm just teaching this way because I think some humor is very helpful to loosen people up, actually. Sometimes meditation retreat can get a bit tense, and to make it the atmosphere a bit looser is very helpful. The Dalai Lama once said, if you get people laughing, you can throw the wisdom pill into their mouth when they have their mouth open. And there's a lot of truth in that, because you become more receptive when you are having fun. When the talk is boring and teacher says things you don't like, then even the things that are true and wise, you won't be able to take in. Anyway, that's not the question. So thank you to your mom for knitting for us. And, yeah, maybe she's watching. Thank you, Mom. Sometimes she watches. It is very special to know that someone all the way from Holland who does not know us is spending time making something for the retreatants. Yeah, so she made many of those batches before, and I'm sure the next batch is already on the way. Yeah. One time, one of those little monks got sold on Ajahn Brahm's auction when he does, well, he doesn't do it himself, but people organize for his birthday. $200! Wow! I told my mother and she couldn't believe it. Those are easy, no questions. We are asked to be kind to hurtful people who are probably hurting others because they are in pain. Are there people who perhaps hurt some people just because they can? What is the place of boundary setting in such situations? Well, we can be kind to people who hurt us, but that doesn't mean we're going to allow them to hurt us, right? We're not doormats. We still have our own say in the matter and our choice, and we can say no when we don't want something to happen. And that is different from being kind. Being kind is to not judge that person negatively or to become angry at them. But you can be kind and at the same time still very, what is the English word for this? Affirmative. Yeah? And have a clear opinion when something they're doing is bad. But then you tell them out of kindness. So are there people who perhaps hurt some people just because they can? Well, in the end, people will do bad things because of various reasons, but in the end it's always because they have some sort of bad desires, or that is the angry crocodile story. The tooth doesn't just mean like physical pain that they have, or but also emotional pain and emotional... Emotional unwholesome qualities. So like things like desire, ill will, and so forth. And you can have compassion for that, because as Buddhists you learn that desire and ill will and so forth are very unhelpful qualities. And those people are just, in the end, just hurting themselves by hurting others. Thank you for this, for your talk this morning, which was Monday. I came on this retreat to put aside the time to rekindle my love of meditation. I've been struggling a lot with sleep. I enjoy the meditation, but I have been sleeping a lot. Thank you for reminding me it is a hindrance. It is a hindrance to see and give love to. Yeah, it's, you know, sometimes you get sleepy. That's all right. As I said, I got sleepy during the meditation, and I was like, okay, I'm going to be sleepy. Doesn't matter. It's all right. It's just something that happens. And one thing about sleepiness, it's also quite a neutral hindrance. Like anger is very negative. Desire has this kind of nasty aspect to it sometimes. And restlessness is not being content. But sleepiness is often just sleepiness, and it's not really negative something about it. Some often just has causes in the past. Like you've been doing too much, for example, thinking too much. So now it's just time for your mind to get a little rest. So when I'm sleepy, I never judge it. I never get ill will towards it. Because if you do, you just make it something that was neutral, now you make it negative. Because you just had sleepiness, now you have sleepiness and ill will. That's much worse. Best just to only have sleepiness. That's all right. I can't really do much bad karma with sleepiness. That's what I'm saying. Also, for telling us that morning that you can struggle too. Of course. I send to kindness and I give myself kindness. Sleep plus meditation plus laughter. What more do I need from a retreat? Maybe maybe blah blah Buddha must look out for them. Maybe a kind of Buddha. I don't know. But what more do I need from retreat? You need less. You don't need anything at all. I don't think that was really a question, so that's helpful as well. I'm probably gonna manage. Wow. Actually, I had all of the hindrances. Welcome to life. Sensory feet kept falling asleep. Ill will to myself. Restlessness. Doubt. Then, no sensual desire you mentioned though. So I'm good. Then my anxiety ensued. I updated this from sleepy to all of them. Okay, you started to sleepy and then it became all of them. Thank you, anxiety. My friend anxiety, who has kept me alive, made me good at my job and funny. Okay, your anxiety makes you funny. That's good. Okay, another non-question actually. But it's very natural to have the hindrances. And this is a bit of a thing with meditation. Sometimes you just go through life and you don't really notice these hindrances. By going through life, I mean maybe you go to the shop and you do your job and you talk to your friends, you go to sleep, you cook, you eat, all these things, and you think you don't have all these hindrances. And then you sit down to meditate and suddenly it feels like they're all rushing over you. But this is just you sitting still, and they were there all along, but now you just start to notice them. So it's not that meditation causes it. It's meditation puts them into the picture, as it were. Makes you aware of them. And of all hindrances, I think Venerable Ananda said it right when we just had a little chat one morning. If you can just get rid of ill will, at least to a large extent, then meditation will be so much more easy. Ill will, we often have towards the hindrances. I said before, you have sleepiness, and now you have sleepiness and ill will, double trouble. Or you start just with restlessness, and then you're like, oh, I should be a better Buddhist. Now you have restlessness and ill will. Again, double trouble. Triple trouble, quadruple trouble. What's next? All the five hindrances trouble. Quintuple trouble, I think. Yes, that's it. And if you can just take out the ill will, then meditation is not so difficult, actually. Because then it's just restlessness. And you're like, okay, restlessness. I'm happy to be restless, whatever. It's good. You know, if you... I don't know, did I say it before? But if you become enlightened now, then I think I said in the beginning, if you become enlightened on the first day, then the rest of the retreat, you have nothing more to do. Boring. You know, just delay enlightenment until the last moment of your life, then you've got your whole life full of all of fun meditation. Well, if you get enlightened, you also get fun meditation, but yeah, no more hindrances. Oh. I don't know, is it boring without hindrances? I don't know. Dear Venerable Sunyo, today I noticed my thoughts in meditation were like watching a dull TV show. No connection with me, but the thoughts were persistent. Any advice on how we move on from this type of thinking? So that's one question, and then it's a supplementary question, but I'll do this one first. When it's like a dull TV show, it's like a little bit of like maybe daydreaming or something is what it sounds like. And in my experience, when you have that like daydreaming thing, that dull thoughts that sort of appear, you also yourself are dull. It's not just the thoughts are dull, but the mind is also dull. So you're a bit sleepy. And often the best thing to do first is to get rid of that sleepiness before you try to still the thoughts. Because again, if you try to still the thoughts first, you'll just fall asleep more often. So see if you can brighten the mind first. Make it more sharp with those techniques I talked about and the technique that Buddha talked about with putting your earlobe. Imagining light, do walking meditation. Sometimes meditate with your eyes open. It can be very helpful as well when you're sleepy. And all those things. Then remove that hindrance first, and then see if you can remove some of the activity that's still going on. And that would be my advice to that. Supplementary question. I notice many of the monks at Bodhiana have an engineering and science type background. Why is that? Yeah, there's just no jobs in engineering, so. So I came here to be like a doll, a bludger. No, yeah, why is that? Interesting. Is it the same with Dhammasara? The many technical nuns?
There are a few.
Yeah. Maybe it's something to do with personality or something. I became an engineer because I was interested in how things work. You know, I wanted to know how do machines work and how do like cars work and factories and stuff. How does that all work? And at some point I also got interested in how does the mind work? How does life work? And maybe as a kind of person who is interested in that sort of question, they become more likely to become monks or something. I don't know. Could be. It is true. There is lots of that engineers and stuff. Ajahn Brahm, of course, studied science as well. But yeah, we've had discussions about that at some point, why that is, but we don't really know. It might just be a coincidence. Or the dog bludging. Hello. It's nice to learn new words sometimes. Dog bludging. Can use that one. Hello. Thank you for your teaching so far. They have been very enjoyable. If there is time, is it possible if you could do a guided metta meditation? Even a short one would be awesome, with metta. I wasn't specifically intending to do it, but I sort of did it in a way when we talked about ill will and stuff. It was maybe a little bit different than what you're used to with metta meditation, like spreading it outwards to other people and stuff. But acceptance is a big aspect of metta as well. So if you can learn to accept your own mind and body,
then that is also a very important part of metta, especially in meditation. Maybe I'll do one tomorrow at the end, but I don't know. It's not that I don't like metta meditation, but sort of want the last meditation to be sort of in the theme of the retreat and not suddenly doing something new, especially maybe some people not so used to metta meditation. I try to live with less sensual pleasures, more like a monk, and for better meditation, but it went wrong. Shall I read on? I had no pleasure, felt like I lost something. My meditation got worse, and I was depressed. Why? Is it because of wrong view? What can I do with that? Can you also say something about Nibbida? I trust the Buddha, but idea to leave the whole world is always sad to me. Thank you. Ah, maybe you're going a bit too fast, you know. You don't. I used to run as a layperson, just to do exercise. And you don't start running doing a marathon on day one. If you do, you'll probably kill yourself or something. And if you practice the Buddha's path, you don't start with Nibbida. And you don't start at the end of the path. You start at the beginning of the path. And this is actually a very similar question to the one we had 2 days ago, I believe, also about Nibbida. So Nibbida is this disillusionment with sensual pleasures and life in general. And you don't start there. That is almost at the end of the path, that disillusionment. It's the result of stream winning, especially. And I think I answered the question already when I said, find pleasures in other spiritual things than just meditation. Find spiritual friends and practice generosity. Maybe you can volunteer for the BSWA, that sort of stuff. It's very important that the path is not just meditation. Often when your mind is like that, you meditate, but it just doesn't feel pleasurable, then maybe some of the fundamentals are not well developed enough yet. So even as monastics, we don't just sit in our hut all day and meditate. I realize for myself, sometimes during the range retreat, at the end of the range retreat, sometimes my meditation gets worse. Why? You could think, why does it get worse? Shouldn't you just build up more and more peace? You got 3 months of range retreat, so 3 months you have nothing to do, so you should be more peaceful at the end. Well, especially in the beginning of my monastic life, it didn't work like that. And I realized that in a range retreat, we also don't do much work. We don't volunteer for things. We don't help out other monks in the monastery much. We basically put a stop to the whole work, and I figured out I'm not doing generosity stuff like that, and that I was missing a bit of that. So I went to Ajahn Brahm and I talked to him about that. He said, yeah, you can like clean up that and do the sweeping and stuff. And then, so I just started doing random jobs in the range retreat just to give back to the monastery, and that lifted me up, and my meditation became better again. So that's why I also like doing teachings like this, because first of all, I hope you get something out of it, which would make me very happy, but it's also a chance for me to give back, and afterwards I know I'll get some energy out of it, because I realized I've been doing something voluntarily. As I said, we don't get paid for it. And, good thing to do.
And that lifts my meditation up as well. So maybe you can do something like that. Dear Ajahn, what makes individuals gravitate towards certain choices, like breaking bad habits or embracing a spiritual path? And is it possible to influence those who may not be interested in making positive choices in life? I got the feeling somebody is living together with somebody. When you try to make people do something, they always rebel. You tell some, it's like kids, you tell them to do something, clean their room, and they won't do it. They just know. So what you can do is be an example for other people. Like, show how happy you can be by breaking your bad habits and by embracing your spiritual path. That's what like people like Venerable Ananda do. They break their bad habits and become a monk. And they embrace their spiritual path, and people find that inspiring. Yeah, I hope none of you think we are dull bludgers, to use the word again. Many of you find it inspiring to see people like Venerable Ananda in the robes. And you don't have to be a monastic to be inspiring. You can be inspiring as a layperson as well, because people notice the way you are, and they notice when you have got rid of certain bad habits you might have had in the past, and they're like, "Wow, that's something different. That doesn't happen often, people giving up their bad habits and embracing spiritual path and being happy." And that's the best way to influence those who may not be interested in those choices. Ajahn Brahm told a story about how, I think it was a lady, asked something similar about how to change her husband. And Ajahn Brahm had brilliant advice. He said, get one of my books, like Opening the Door of Your Heart, and read it every day, and tell your husband that this is your private book. He is not allowed to read it. Then it becomes like the cookie jar, you know, that you're not allowed. When I was a kid, we had a whole cupboard full of candy and food that I could just open and get stuff. But my father had his private candy jar high up. And the only candy I was interested in was the candy jar that I couldn't reach. So Ajahn Brahm said, tell your husband he's not allowed to read this book. And of course, you know what happened. The husband sneakily read the book. And so he got influenced regardless. For the last 6 months, I have been enjoying the benefits of regular exercise at moderate intensity. Other than exercise and meditation, can you tell me what other practices we can incorporate into our lives in order to have more peace and less suffering with metta? Well, many of the things I mentioned already, but there's a question about health. And because you say exercise and stuff. And I told you before about how with my mind I was able to change those perceptions of pain into pleasure. And the mind is so much more powerful than we often realize. And it can even help you stay healthy, not just by doing meditation, but sometimes even more actively can keep you healthy. Once during a range retreat again, I was very sick. I developed this nasal infection. Well, for me, that is very sick, because I usually don't get sick. But I had this really bad nasal infection and this terrible headache. And my nose just kept on dripping, just like that person who asked the question yesterday, but probably even worse. It just came out all the time. and I felt miserable and bad, and my whole head, I felt my heart like pounding, like in my head. And I thought, I should try and get some sleep. I should try and get some sleep, so maybe tomorrow I feel a little bit better at least. And I tried to fall asleep, didn't work. Then I thought, I'm a monk. And Ajahn Brahm often talks about meditating when you're sick. Maybe he's crazy. Maybe there's something to it. And so let's try. See what happens. So I said, I can remember so clearly, I sat up in my hut, meditating, just like I usually do, but making extra sure I had a lot of kindness. Because when you're sick and your head goes like, it's very hard to be kind with that. But I build up some kindness, and then like this, I basically started in the middle, built up a lot of kindness where I was comfortable, and then I investigate the sickness a little bit. Move my intention and my attention to that headache. Got a little bit too much, I went back to the kindness again, build up more kindness. And started investigating further that headache until I could put it in the center of my attention. It was like, not just the headache, but I've sort of like found the source of the illness, for lack of better words. I can't really explain it, but I just knew where it was, like in my body or something. And I could just focus only on that, only my attention on that. And as soon as I had it in the center of my awareness and with kindness, it was like it exploded. I couldn't explain it any better than that, like it exploded. It sounds silly, but that's how it felt like to me. And when I did that, I knew that instant that I was no longer sick. And like a minute later, it was all gone. So I fixed it, not with medicine, not by going to the doctor, but by using my own mind. And that is possible to do. And I only had a nasal infection, but sometimes these things are just so too coincidental almost. But next week, Ajahn Brahm gave a talk, and he was speaking about how his teacher, Ajahn Chah, once had, I think he had double malaria or something like that. Really, really sick. Much worse than a nasal infection. And Ajahn Chah was also like, what am I going to do? There's no doctor here. Let's meditate. And what did Ajahn Chah do? This is how Ajahn Brahm explained it. Of course, I've never met Ajahn Chah myself. So I only hear this second hand. But Ajahn Brahm said, Ajahn Chah went right into the middle of the sickness. And then he explained to us that it just exploded. I was like, wow, this is exactly, he explains exactly what I did. That is crazy. Then Ajahn Chah got better as well. So he even cured malaria with it. And I do 100% believe that, because I did something myself, although it was only like something smaller than malaria. But that is how you can use meditation to be healthy. But other than that, I'm a meditation teacher, and a Buddhist teacher, so other advice to be healthy, you'll have to get from somewhere else. There. Yeah. 58. Pretty good. Dear Ajahn, I am noticing time and time again that I have a judgmental mind towards myself and others. Where does this come from, and how to ease it? It seems to get worse with age. LOL. Smiley face. Thanks. Well, you can't be that old yet if you use LOL. Smiley face. So be ready. It might get much, much more worse. Because it's many years to go. No, no, no. It gets worse with age. I only got one advice, do more metta meditation. I didn't really teach it yet. But maybe some people just get more grumpy when they are old. No, don't be one of those people. And I don't know why you would get worse, but maybe you're just noticing it more. And because you're more aware of, you're made more aware that it is like a problem, that it is something that doesn't make you happy. Now you're noticing what has already always been there. That's what I think is happening. It's not getting worse. It seems to get worse, you say, but it's only maybe because you notice it more. So you have a judgmental mind towards yourself and others. Where does it come from? Probably because you think that you and others should be better and shouldn't be imperfect. But it's imperfections that make life possible. And if you were already perfect, then you wouldn't be here. She wouldn't be born. So often we have this perfectionist attitude, and that's why we get judgmental with ourselves. And I talked about that before. People think they should be better Buddhists. People think they should be enlightened by now. And one time I was in another monastery, not Bodhinyana monastery. And I stayed there for a while. And there were other monks there. And we were working together and just talking a little bit. And I said, I've been a monk for 5 years now and I'm still not enlightened. And that other monk said, well, I'm an Ajahn and I still feel like a teenager. So it is natural to not be perfect. Even many of the monks still, and nuns as well, I assume, have more practice to do. And we learn as we grow. And sometimes it feels like we're going backwards. But don't judge too soon. Because let's imagine that here at the bottom is being totally unenlightened. Here. And here at the top is being enlightened. And this is, I'm an engineer, so I'm thinking graphs, you know. So the y-axis is how enlightened you are. The x-axis is time. So we think it should be like this. Just a straight line up from unenlightened to enlightenment. But often what it's like, it's more like this. Like the economy. But the economy eventually always crashes, but enlightenment, you, at least there is like a rising tendency in the line. Yeah? If you would do like a function approximation. No. I'm getting too much into it now. So the line, yeah, I know somebody who knows mathematics. So the line, the general tendency is up, but sometimes we only focus on when it temporarily goes down. Yeah? So don't focus on those times. Just judge your practice over long stretches of time. Judge it over years, not months. Because in those months you might go backwards. But in the years, you'll grow. So also for people who want to maybe join a monastery one day, don't judge too soon whether it's the right place or whether you're getting something out of it, because you might just be in one of those temporary temporary crashes of your enlightenment economy. But eventually, you always keep increasing. And that's how you know whether you are
on the right path or not. So I actually managed to do it, and I'm really proud of that. And also, thank you everybody for your questions. They were very good. And also thank you for some of the nice comments as well. I didn't even read them all out, some I kept for myself. So thank you, and let's all say triple sadhu for the Buddha's teachings. Sadhu, 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 sadhu. Oh wait, sadhu. Okay. All right, gusto. See you again tomorrow.